There's a special way of doing that in the K-12 formula. The way to do that for ESDs is just saying, well, if the per student amounts and the cost is less than the revenue that's going to be available, we'll just take and increase everybody by the same percentage to use up the available dollars. So even if a district initially has those per student dollar amounts in that table, for example, they could get more than that on a per student basis, depending on how accurate the estimates are. It could get less than that. So there's no guarantee in terms of even those dollar amounts that are in the table being the final result, because they have to go through this balancing process of making the dollars to be distributed the same as the revenue available. And again, that's new for the ESDs. But again, it's mimicking the process for K-12. If there's ever any consolidation, it will make it easier because they will be having kind of parallel processes in terms of distribution. Now, that process starts the equalization process for ESDs, because you are bringing up the lower ESDs and not giving any increases on a per student basis, at least to the higher funded ESDs, so that you're starting to narrow the gap between the high and the low. But you're doing that in a but you still have a substantial variation on a per student basis by district. You still don't have a permanent distribution formula. It's temporary for this biennium. The legislature will have to do something again next biennium. And there's still no definition of what equity is for ESDs, like there is for K-12. We have those per student differences. They're narrowing, but we don't have any logic behind why the differences are there, other than history. So that will have to be dealt with. Now, what the legislature did do for the interim is to set up this ESD task force. And the role of the task force is to just review regional service delivery. The task force charge is kind of unique in that it's very explicit and very detailed in terms of the issues that have to be addressed by the task force, what questions should be answered. Most task forces don't get that kind of detailed direction. Right? But this one does, and I think they're going to follow it very well. Basically, they are to identify any services that can be provided more efficiently on a regional basis. But the statute says, to begin with, assume ESDs do not exist. What kind of services should be provided on a regional basis? Just because it's the most efficient way to provide those services. They decide that none are, I assume that their work is over in very short order. But again, they're likely to find that, yes, it does make sense, and it's the most efficient way to do it on a regional basis. It might come up with a different kind of scheme from what we think of as ESDs, in terms of those providers or regions, or whether certain services should be provided if the region has this kind of density, or additional services if the density is higher or lower, what have you. Basically, they have to go back and start from scratch and say, right, if we were to start over, what should we design? Right, so once they identify those services, then what's the delivery method that works best for those services? And once you know, is it at the state level? Is it at a regional level? Is it districts contracting with a regional entity? All kinds of possibilities, and some of those are listed that they need to address. Then once that is done, they're to look at the administrative method and decide, well, how can this best be administered? What kind of role do the districts need to play? If there's a regional service provider, if there's a board, what should the makeup of that board be, especially for representation by the school districts? And then once they have that in place, last, given all of that, what kind of funding method makes sense? And how do you define equity in that process? It's a lot of work, a lot of questions to answer for that task force. They are starting out updating an old report that listed all of the services that ESDs provide school districts. It might just be one ESD providing that service, but knowing that and knowing what that service is. And seeing from that list if they can make some groups of those services and perhaps start at that level to work with those groups and say, yeah, this group makes sense or doesn't make sense, or the service should be maybe moved from one category to another, and finally come up with some kind of list of regional services that can be provided very efficiently. They are to give their report, final report, October of 1999, no, excuse me, 2000, just before the session starts, but they're also to report to you periodically. So that will have to be worked into your agenda. I think that they'll come to you and say, this is what we've been doing, this is where we're at, this is what we think we're going to decide or what we have decided, and then probably look for some feedback from you. So that's why I'm taking this time to talk about this, so that you are aware of what's going on and have some time to think about how you might want to respond if they ask for your feedback when they come to report to you.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. We had an ESD task force in the last interim, didn't we?
Interim, no.
Did we not? I thought they were supposed to come back with recommendations to the 99 session. They ended up coming back to us and saying they didn't have any recommendations.
I'm sort of loose.
Well, I was going to ask.
It wasn't a formal task force, yeah. As I recall.
Peggy Lynch is shaking her head. Yes, she agrees with me.
All right. Well, then
that's
informal.
Okay. So I guess that my next question was going to be whether the charge to this task force is more explicit than was to the group that met in the last interview. I'm glad to hear that, because it didn't seem to come forward with much.
Yes, the legislation named the superintendent of education as the chair of this group. Got, I think, 17 members that have been appointed. It has funding that it has under $50,000 to use to gather whatever information they want to use that for. So the resources are there to come up with a report.
All right. Representative Rasmussen, since you sort of spearheaded that, do you have something to add?
Well, just that as we were crafting the work for that task force and the charge to that task force, I was aware that ESDs were having some difficulty coming together and coming to clear conclusions about what was best for how they would be structured, and there was a lot of tension at the time between various school districts and their service districts, and so we worked very hard to specifically make this as successful as possible by lodging it with the superintendent of education and setting out a more clear statement of goals than as has been there more normally. I just clearly, as we were coming to grips with equity within K-12, it was time to take on the work of the ESD. So, since you all are going to be here, or most of you, will be here in the 99 session, or the 2001, I hope you all work with this very carefully, because it is the next very big piece of the K-12 puzzle.
Steve, before you proceed, we do have our guests from Treasury, so maybe we can...
That's a good break point, because that's the end of the ESD portion.
Okay, very good. Marianne? Self-introduced there? Okay.
Thank you.
We're committee members. We're going to shift gears now for a moment and talk about the tobacco settlement for a few minutes. And we are privileged to have Mr. Larkins, Rob Larkins, with us from Morgan Stanley Dean Witter in the Public Finance Department, who has done a lot of analysis on the financial aspects of the tobacco settlement. That's what we want to consider at this point, not the policy, but the finance of it. So we're glad you could be with us, and please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Rob Larkins from Morgan Stanley. What I've attempted to put together here is an overview of the settlement, and the financial issues, the risks and opportunities to the state, and you have copies of my handout, and please feel free to interrupt at any time. I've tried to keep this to 20 or 30 minutes of prepared material, but we'll do it as you see fit. On page one, listed the overview of the topics we'd like to address, a quick overview of the settlement, some of the policy considerations, options for mitigating the state's risk, what is a securitization, and the investor perspective. On page two, we've outlined an overview of the master settlement agreement. It's a very complex document, took probably thousands of hours of legal hours to arrive at. But essentially what you have, and if you distill it to its essence, what you have is four companies making a series of formula-driven payments. And you have shown here the schematic, which is the settlement is really between the U.S. domestic tobacco industry and the settling states and territories. There's significant concentration in that industry, and so the big four manufacturers represent almost 97% market share. They make a series of these formula-driven payments that I'll get into in a moment annually to an escrow agent, and then the escrow agent will allocate those payments out to states who have achieved state-specific finality under the settlement, and Oregon has achieved that stage under the settlement. Your 30-year unadjusted total is about $2.8 billion, and I stress unadjusted because the numbers you may read about in the popular press are simply the point of departure for a variety of calculations that happen annually. But when you think of this settlement from a revenue perspective, from a policy perspective, it's important to keep in mind that what you essentially have here is a consumption tax, a cigarette consumption tax levied against the U.S. domestic tobacco industry. And so in thinking of sort of who is paying your tax or who is your counterparty or, and as I'll talk about later in my remarks, your investment, what is the credit quality of these companies who are going to be making these payments over time? And it's also important to recognize that they are designed to be paid in perpetuity. There are various time frames used to calculate 25 or 30 years, but the settlement is supposed to be in perpetuity. We've outlined here on page three the current market share and then the ratings on the parent companies of the participating manufacturers. And also important in the allocation of payments is the fact that the annual number that is arrived at is distributed annually among the participating manufacturers according to the prior year's market share. So, for example, the payment that the industry would make in the year 2000 would be based upon the volume of cigarettes shipped in the United States for 1999, and I'll speak more to that in a moment. What you can see is there's tremendous concentration in the industry. Philip Morris, about a 50% market share. R.J. Reynolds, approximately 24%. Brown & Williamson, which is British American Tobacco, just under 14%. And Lorillard, which is owned by Lowe's, is just under 9%. And the ratings here range from sort of solidly A to the weak investment grade category. R.J. Reynolds was just put back into the investment grade category recently.
Mr. Larkins?
Yes.
This market share is their percent of the cigarette domestic market, right?
Yes.
And the Standard & Poor's and the Moody's, are they on just the cigarette portion of their business, or is that on their total portion? Like, I know that there a lot of those are diversified in other.
Exactly. Products. That is on the parent company. The only one of these where the parent and the domestic subsidiary are the same is R.J. Reynolds. With the spinoff from Nabisco, RJR is RJR, and so it is what you see. The rating agencies have indicated in their published material that the underlying companies may be as much as a half a notch lower than the parents. The obligors would be potentially rated lower than the parent. As you know, Philip Morris owns Kraft and is Miller Beer and others. It's a large conglomerate.
Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I want to clarify then. The obligor is not the parent company. It's the...
It is the U.S. domestic
tobacco
subsidiary.
Company, not the parent. Okay.
Correct. And further to that point, it's only cigarettes shipped in the United States. So,
yep. But that's a good point then. If Philip Morris has one rating, but the tobacco company under Philip Morris has another rating, then really what we're looking at is the rating of the tobacco company and not the parent company?
Yes. And actually, it does. There are the subsidiaries. The only one that has a rating is RJR. the domestic subsidiaries are not rated in and of themselves. So this is as good as it gets. Page 4 outlines the calculation of the payments, and there is in the settlement a very well-specified sequence of calculations that takes place annually. The National Association of Attorneys General, or NAG, and the industry mutually agreed upon PricewaterhouseCoopers as calculation agent. So annually what happens, they look up and they take your base payment number. Again, those would be the numbers that add up to your $2.8 billion, and they go through a series of calculations. Your payments are inflation adjusted, so they'll be increased by the greater of the consumer price index, or 3% per year. And the resulting figure is then volume adjusted. And this is the most important factor in your considerations, and it's in red because volume is expected to go down. And so all of your payments will be volume indexed to shipments versus a 1997 base year. Because the industry wanted the settlement to function as a sort of total solution to their state and local government litigation risk, there was a so-called previously settling states reduction, which factors in payments to the original four settling states of Florida, Minnesota, Minnesota and Texas. And there is a so-called non-settling states reduction, which at this point is moot because everybody is likely to settle, and a non-participating manufacturer's adjustment. That was the reverse side of the same coin of the model statute, which Oregon has adopted. The idea here being that for companies that didn't sign up and obligate themselves to make these payments, the industry didn't want to have an unlevel playing field, so that there's an offset, and a very serious offset, if those companies gain market share. And again, having adopted the model statute, I think that risk to you is really not significant. So annually, what happens is on a calendar year cycle, the calculation agent will go through these calculations and then establish the gross amount payable by the industry to the escrow agent, and that amount is then carved up among the participating manufacturers on the basis of market share. So as I mentioned, the biggest adjustment factor here is volume. And what we've shown on page 5 is historical and projected U.S. cigarette consumption. Consumption and shipments over time are the same thing. There are quarterly and annual discrepancies sometimes because of inventory factors, and shipments is what is measured, but this is a historical and then projected consumption. What you can see is cigarette consumption peaked in the early 80s and has experienced an annual decline of 1 to 2% per year. Our analyst, who covers the industry from the equity research side, believes that volume for this year will be down about 9.3%. And that reflects the price increase that the industry took last year to pay for the settlement. Prices were raised to fund the settlement payments, and that resulted in a decrease in consumption. The aberrations over the next few years have to do with scheduled increases in the federal excise tax, and there is a pretty significant correlation between price and consumption. Our analyst has a so-called elasticity assumption of negative 3.5%. So that a 10% or 0.35, excuse me, a 10% increase in prices would impact volume by 3.5%. His long-term volume projection for the industry is down 1.4% per year, which would show up directly in your payments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Robert Larkins.
Mr. Larkins, is this a generally accepted formula by which there's this inverse relation between how much the tax goes up and how much consumption?
There is. The various analysts who cover the industry may have a slightly different elasticity assumption of maybe 0.25% or 0.4%, but it's all in the sort of 0.25 to 0.5% correlation.
But I thought I saw just recently that there's still about 24-25% of the population that smoke cigarettes, and I mean, there's got to be a point of diminishing returns at some level where it's not going to continue down to zero.
There's apparently significant evidence around the country that smoking among younger people is actually on the rise.
Mm. That's what I mean. There's sort of a point at which that tax versus decline in consumption sort of levels out, or The percentage of decline lessens.
Exactly. A 50 cent increase on a $2 pack is a lot more meaningful than once your base is at 250, which is why, frankly, our analyst has the decline at a more level annual decline, given that you've now adjusted the price upward.
The increase in smoking among young people, doesn't that portend an increase over the years to come? I mean, you've got people moving into the market.
That would.
Is that factored out of these elasticity projections?
I don't quite pretend to know what goes into his model, but he does a lot of modeling, a lot of polling. And
in other words, a lot of smoke.
Yeah.
A couple of mirrors.
Yeah.
Paul?
Mr. Larkin, I had a question on kind of pricing strategy and what you see as risks there. I know one of the elements of the settlement is to antitrust scrutiny will be less for the companies, and there's some concern on the part of FTC that there may be bigger price increases than just simply a pass-through. Is that something you see as a big risk?
I'm really not qualified to speak to that, other than I am knowledgeable that there is significant concentration in the industry, and what you do have is so-called brand momentum, and Philip Morris has brands that appear to have a greater consumer loyalty, and so also in the absence of advertising, which is one of the terms of the settlement, it's pretty hard for new entrants to gain share, and so the bigger likely to get bigger. Page 6 we've outlined is a schedule of your unadjusted settlement receipts, and I emphasize unadjusted. There are actually three categories of payments under the settlement. There are the initial upfront payments, there's the so-called annual payments, which is in fact what most people have focused on. Those are the payments that continue in perpetuity. And the third category are the strategic contribution fund payments, or SCF payments, which were allocated among the various states in consideration of their attorney's general contribution to the settlement. So we've totaled them up there for you on page 6. Over time, it's $2.8 billion in nominal terms. And then we've done a calculation there for you, which we will talk about in greater detail later on, where we've taken the present value of those dollars, and at 6.5%, the today's value of that stream of money at 6.5%, which would be a tax-exempt borrowing rate, is about $1.2 billion. The present value of that same stream at a 9.5% interest rate, which would be a taxable cost of borrowing, is about $927 million. And so when you look at various proposals and ideas on securitization, these numbers are helpful memo items for you.
So when you say unadjusted, these figures then don't take into account either the inflationary adjustments that you showed us earlier on the calculations, the annual calculations, for the sales adjustments, the shipment adjustments?
Correct. These are just raw numbers. On page 7.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Butler.
Just one question for Mr. Larkin. Isn't there a whole series of escape clauses, probably the largest of which would be the development of a nicotine-free tobacco or a nicotine-free smoking device of some sort that would preclude nicotine from entering the system, which would negate all of the settlement? Is that not part of
it? It wouldn't negate the settlement directly, but if people aren't buying cigarettes, it would impact your payments.
Okay, so the development of that may impact the amount of cigarettes that are sold, but it would not affect the payment schedule that we've been given today.
Right.
Okay.
On page 7, we've outlined some of the policy considerations, and that was probably a good segue for some of the risk issues. As I mentioned at the outset, that the settlement functions as a consumption tax levied against the U.S. tobacco industry. And the policy question we like to put in front of people is how many eggs can the golden goose lay? You had the MSA in the original four settlements. You had the federal government suing the industry on the Medicare statute. You have the Engle case in Florida. You have other states' taxes. And you had the administration's recent attempts to include a tobacco tax in the budget. And there probably are more. The point being that all of these actions would put pressure, financial pressure on the industry, and most likely cause the industry to raise prices. Prices are likely to reduce your volume, which would reduce your payments. And I think what we want, the point we want to drive home here is that while we expect the industry to remain viable for the foreseeable future, our settlement beneficiaries, are the states in a position to monitor and absorb that risk. And you are very good at predicting income tax or sales tax or various macroeconomic taxes, but you're not a producing state. And I would submit to you that you do not have the resources within your organization to monitor that risk. We have a team of 8 people who do nothing but follow this industry, and that's 24 hours a day practically. And it, the industry's financial profile is driven by its litigation risk. And we've shown here on page 7 that the settlement resolved state and local government lawsuits. It did not resolve individual, class action, or third-party payer lawsuits. Did not resolve federal or foreign government lawsuits. Now, the industry has a whole raft of defenses, assumption of risk. There's a whole chapter and verse on that. But the point being, from a budget standpoint, as you're building financial plans for the next several years, do you have the resources to project and monitor your income stream from this particular source? And the rating agencies, frankly, have addressed that very issue on page 8. They have warned against what we have called settlement dependency, and that's our term, not theirs, but the quote was from a Standard & Poor's report put out in the spring of this year, and I'll just read the intro, that government should resist temptations to use the receipts from the agreement to support operations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as one client remarked to us early on in this discussion, if we're successful in our anti-smoking efforts, there won't be any money. So why should you think about, and why are other states thinking about, a securitization? And we'll get into in a moment what that entails. There's two roads here on a securitization. If you have so-called qualified governmental projects, these are projects for state facilities, K-12 school infrastructure, capital expenditures. Those can be financed on a tax-exempt basis. So earlier on when I said your present value of that stream at 6.5%, that's your tax-exempt discount rate, you could raise about $1.2 billion. That's on a tax-exempt basis. A taxable securitization, it's the exact same structure and legal issues. It's just a different cost because of the federal tax implications. But a taxable securitization would enable a beneficiary without current project needs to convert a long-term single industry receivable. You might think of it as a tobacco industry guaranteed investment contract or a tobacco industry bond. And that's what you have here, is a stream of revenue from a single industry. It would allow you to convert that into a diversified investment portfolio. And that trust fund, that portfolio, could provide you with a long-term funding source for projects and or programs. And so I would submit to you that the issue of trust fund versus securitization is not an either-or. In fact, a securitization can enhance the viability of a trust fund by converting it, as we've shown here, from a single industry risk into a diversified portfolio. And along those lines, on page 10, just sort of how to think about this in a slightly different way, your MSA, or the Master Settlement Agreement, receivable is an asset. And I would submit to you that state investment policies would probably preclude you from holding this asset if it came to you in the form of bonds, because of industry concentration, because of credit considerations, and because of illiquidity. And most fiduciaries would be compelled to divest of some or all of this receivable. And if you were the board of trustees of the Oregon Nonprofit Inc. and one of your wealthy residents left you $1 billion of tobacco bonds and you called up your asset allocation consultant and said, what should we do? They'd say you probably should sell at least half of it, just out of standard diversification principles. And we've provided some more information on that after this. So what is a securitization? It is simply where the owner of a contractually obligated revenue stream, which is what you have here, sells that stream to a special purpose entity in exchange for an upfront payment. You're cashing it out, if you will. The special purpose entity then issues bonds backed solely by the purchased revenue stream. So there's no recourse to the seller. You sell the stream, you get your cash, and to finance the purchase of that stream, the special purpose entity sells debt. After the debt service has been satisfied, any excess cash flow, the so-called residual, would flow back to you. And we've put in a little schematic here showing how that might work, where you would sell your settlement receivables to this special purpose entity in purple on page 11, and then that special purpose entity would take the annual settlement payments, service its bonds, fill up any debt service reserve fund, the blue box, and then the surplus would flow back to the state annually in the form of a residual. That, for all of the mystique and talk about securitization, is what it is. And page 12 tries to bring it home to a more everyday example, and really securitization lies at the heart and the foundation of the residential home lending business. If you go to the bank and take out a $100,000 home loan at 8% for 30 years, you become contractually obligated to make 360 payments to the bank, which add up to $264,000 over time. The bank is contractually entitled to receive the same stream of payments. The present value of the bank or the lender's expected income stream, discounted at 8%, is $100,000. You're the bank here. You're expecting $2.8 billion from this industry, and the present value of that is, again, anywhere from $900 to $1.2 billion, depending upon your method of financing. On page 13, a fancy fold-out chart, just kind of lets you know how we got there. And what we have in the blue line are the total unadjusted payments that I spoke to earlier, which add up to $2.8 billion over time. And if you were to securitize that or sell it off and raise funds, you could sell bonds, or the entity to which you sold the stream could sell bonds where the debt service would amount up to the red line. And these are based upon rating criteria put out by Moody's in conjunction with the New York City securitization. And we go through a series of calculations here showing how on page 13, again at the bottom, you've got the three columns adding up to the total unadjusted payments. It's the fourth column from the left adding up to $2.8 billion. What Moody's has said is, in order to get a rating in the A or better category, and there's a variety of permutations, but sort of the base case, is they're going to subject those cash flows to a volume reduction of 12% in the first year, 7% in the next year, and 4% per year thereafter. So that's sort of their conservative view of the world as to an A-rated revenue stream that they would let you bond against. And then that's how we come up with the column labeled maximum annual debt service. And if you take the present value of that, and again, we do this on a taxable scenario, you come up with $719 million, and the proceeds of that are $627 million. And the residual, that last column, would be funds which flow back to you annually in arrears to the extent that these payments materialize as expected. The important thing in a securitization is once you've sold that revenue stream and that entity that purchased it has sold the bonds, you're out of the equation as far as your debt service exposure. You are at risk for the residual. If payments come in less than expected, the state's residual would be the first stream to suffer. But in terms of paying back the $719 million of bonds, that is not your obligation. And that is a well-established convention in the taxable and tax-exempt securitization markets. So there's a lot of material here, but we just wanted to give you the evidence or the supporting data for the bonding capacity projection that we give you here. Page 14 gives you a snapshot of what other states are doing here. There's a variety of proposals out there. In Colorado, I know the Treasurer has been very vocal with his securitization proposal that he wants to eliminate the conflict of interest that the state has between spending money on anti-smoking efforts and being the recipient of these funds. Virginia, we've actually been retained to implement the governor's transportation program, where they're going to finance about $600 million of road programs and projects from a securitization. Louisiana is looking at a trust fund. There's a variety of strategies, and I won't go through them all here, but point is that, many, many states are looking at this concept. Page 15 is just to show you a little bit about the settlement finality. We are now technically final. There was the so-called 80-80 test in the settlement that required that in order for the money to begin to flow, that 80% of the states representing 80% of the payments had to achieve so-called state-specific finality, which was you've entered into a consent decree with the industry and gone through all of the relevant appeals processes in your state. And we're now there. Virginia was the state that put us over the 80% threshold. You, having achieved state-specific some time ago, have been in a position to do a securitization for some time. Page 16 answers the question, when are we going to see some money? And now that there is state-specific finality, or I should say a national settlement finality, there was a payment made by the industry in December of 98 that was escrowed until finality happened. And now that we have finality, we would anticipate sometime this month you will receive that your share of that payment. We calculate that to be about $27.5 million. Reflecting the volume declines for 1998. And then we've outlined here the payments you would receive between now and June 30. Last topic I wanted to address was the investor perspective. And you're probably sitting there thinking, well, if this thing is so risky, why would anybody buy this? And I think it really has to do with your perspective and your business mission where you sit. You have an illiquid receivable. You're going to be getting this money, but it's a revenue stream that only you're entitled to. If you proceed with the securitization and sell the revenue stream, the bonds that are issued as part of that have greater liquidity than your contractually obligated revenue stream. The second reason investors would buy this is yield. The third is diversification, and the fourth is what's called non-correlated risk. That what investors are looking for, professional portfolio managers, are assets which don't all move together. And so certainly there are cyclical and counter-cyclical industries, and this really industry is divorced from all those forces if you look at the performance of tobacco company stocks and bonds. So there are investors out there who have an appetite for these securities, and as I put in the yellow box, that risk isn't inherently bad. It's the issue of appropriateness of that risk in light of your business mission. On page 18, and to sort of drive that point home, the optimal portfolio composition depends upon your objectives. If you're a high-yield bond fund and people have put money in your fund seeking high yield, you're supposed to have the majority of your assets in high yield. That's your job. And so a typical asset allocation for a high-yield bond fund would be 90% high-yield bonds and 10% in cash or government bonds. A typical college or university endowment would have the middle pie chart. And the far chart on the right shows the Oregon Pension Fund asset allocation. And again, making the point that holding this receivable on your books may not be suitable for the state, but investing in settlement-backed bonds is an attractive proposition for many professional bond investors. So the last page is just a summary. Now that the settlement is final, payments should commence this fiscal year. Number two, a securitization would enable a beneficiary such as the state to exchange tobacco industry risk to professional investors for an upfront payment. And as I pointed out before, you would keep any residual, the difference between the actual receipt of funds and the debt service payments due on the securitization. We believe you could raise up to $627 million in net proceeds through a taxable offering. And we think that you should consider moving on this expeditiously to create a more stable and diversified long-term source of funding, and particularly in light of the industry litigation risks that I touched upon earlier. So I'd be happy to take questions.
Any more questions, Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't it also correct that in addition to having greater stability because of the diversification, that there's a good opportunity to get a higher rate of return than what the discount would be?
There is. I think most retirement systems around the country typically have an 8% actuarial assumption rate, but if you look at what they've actually been earning Over the past 15 years, it's in the teens. A diversified portfolio would be significantly greater than your cost of funding. That's correct.
Representative Chairman, thank you.
I think you said that the state can both have a security fund and securitize the settlement. Is that specifically true with respect to our House Bill 2007 that will be out before the voters next year, and the Treasury folks are telling me no?
I don't believe your bill has securitization authority within it. It sort of gets you halfway there. It has a trust fund, but you now would have a trust fund with a bunch of tobacco company securities in it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Larkins. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was something in the early part of your presentation about recommending that states not rely on this as a source of revenue for other things. I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but it seems like if you use securitization, you're fairly safe in knowing what amount of money that you're looking at. Then it just becomes really a policy question, state by state, of how you want to use those monies.
I would agree.
Statement.
You go from relying on a highly concentrated a revenue stream from an industry, frankly, that the state and virtually all the other states are trying to put out of business, to a pot of money that you control, that you manage, that and the rating agencies have endorsed that outlook, which is relying on income off of a diversified trust is perfectly prudent. But if you build this money into your budget, you're becoming potentially hooked on a revenue stream that's going to go away.
Jay Patrick?
I just wondered, aside from bonding, is there any kind of equity-based vehicle that the state could sell the revenue stream to, as opposed to doing? Because I know we could bond internally, we could sell to some outside bonding agency, or we could do something with equities. Is there any equity strategies that anyone's looking at, or are there any, or are states doing it themselves? Are they doing any kind of bonding capacity themselves? I know you said earlier that we probably didn't have the resources to monitor the industry as well as we probably be able to do, but I'm just wondering.
A couple of thoughts. I probably should have been clear in responding to Representative Witt's question that in looking at the cost of monetizing this versus your investment opportunity, the math is significantly more compelling if you have equity investment authority. And I know that in Louisiana, for example, their trust fund statute or which they're pursuing would give the trust fund equity authority, which I understand here is a constitutional issue. But it's a to have really the long-term earnings potential from the trust fund, you would want your investment policies ideally to look like your retirement system where you can invest in equities. In terms of your ability to finance this or monetize this on a more equity-like basis, we've done a lot of thinking about sort of what is this animal, and I would say the residual has very significant equity-like characteristics, that the performance of that excess is going to depend much more on factors that would drive the stock price of these companies. And we're not there yet, but there's some interesting things being thought about. But in terms of you selling, really what you're doing in a securitization is you're selling participations in that stream. The question has come up in a lot of places, well, why don't we just sell off the revenue stream? And rather than go through the securitization, we'll just sell it. And the lottery analogy is used quite a bit of people getting cashed out. Really what happens when someone shows up to buy your revenue stream, all they're going to do is securitize it and keep the economics for themselves. The types of lenders who would buy a cashed out lottery are insurance companies and pension funds who are not particularly interested in tobacco company risk. And the difference with the lottery and this is the lottery is essentially a general obligation of the state and a fixed amount. You know exactly the amount per year that you're discounting. Here, your discounting gets a lot hairier because you're trying to account for the potential variations in volume. And so our response to states who say, well, why don't we just do an auction, would be you can get to the same place with the securitization, but you have a seat at the table and you can really determine the outcome of that process with a lot greater accuracy. I don't know if I've answered your question on the equity issue, but that's been my thoughts on it. Yeah.
Mr. Larkins, thank you very much for your information.
Thank you for having me.
And Mary Ann Raleigh, thank you for making it happen. We're going to continue with this discussion and skip our break until we get through this next presentation, since the Attorney General is taken time to come over and speak to the committee. So, Mr. Myers, why don't you come on ahead? I've been hearing about some of the activities of you and your colleagues.
Mr. Chair, members, for your record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I'm pleased to be here at the committee's invitation to discuss the master settlement agreement with you as part of your review of the new revenue stream that we have and issues, I guess, about use, ultimately. Before I talk about the master settlement agreement, let me talk for a moment about the underlying litigation which led to it. We were one of 50 states and territories, 54 states and territories that had either considered or filed litigation. Ultimately, 54 were in the settlement. I think 40-some were actually suing states and territories. Our claims were dominantly under the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act in connection with targeting of minors in efforts to get them to smoke, as well as misrepresentations with respect to the addictive qualities of the tobacco products. We also had claims footed in antitrust law and other claims. A portion of the economics of the case, as far as damages claim, would have been under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in terms of individual penalties for each violation. Portion of the claims were framed in terms of increased costs to Oregon in its Medicaid program for treating smoking-related illnesses. Although we were one of the later suing states, we were one of the first states to be set for trial. And indeed, we would have been, I think, about the third state to go to trial if, in fact, the national settlement had not occurred. We were set to go to trial in, I believe it's April of next year, April of 2000. We filed in May or June of 1997, so we had a very, very tight turnaround period. Or, sorry, it would have been April of 99 we would have gone to trial, so we would have had somewhat less than a two-year period. So an enormous effort was invested in the litigation itself, and I'm proud to note before going on to the agreement that in assessing the relative effort of each state and territory in contributing to the total settlement outcome measured by amount of internal activity compared to external, by the amount of assistance provided to other states, Oregon's effort was ranked very high. I think initially about 14th in the nation, and then it declined somewhat because there was a holdback from a strategic contribution fund that was used to make these supplemental awards to the states and territories, and some other states' amounts were enhanced. Let me turn now to the agreement itself, which is really composed of two major segments. One is what I guess I would refer to as a marketing or non-economic, that might not be a completely correct description, non-economic, but it's a marketing segment, and it consists of agreed restrictions undertaken by the industry on various choices it could make with respect to the advertising and marketing of products. For example, the agreement eliminates the use of cartoons. The Joe Camel cartoon is gone as a result of the national agreement. And most of the marketing restrictions are framed at constraints on advertising choices that could impact youth, young smokers. It's primarily oriented toward trying to reduce the amount of advertising contact of tobacco products with youth. The economic side of the agreement consists of actually several parts. I'm not going to mention all of them. The largest, most significant component, of course, is the settlement commitments that involve annual payments to the states. And I'd like to, if I could, Mr. Chair, have distributed to you an Oregon-specific schedule of those. And I'll have Mr. Shepherd, who's with me, run over those in just a moment, if I could. In addition to the basic settlement commitment that involves the annual and perpetual payments to the states, there is a national foundation that is created under the agreement, which will be used to fund national anti-tobacco efforts. There is a fund created to assist states with the enforcement of the agreement. And, of course, the litigation costs themselves, both public, the litigation costs of the states were also compensated as part of the settlement. A separate fund was established. Oregon will recover on a market rate basis its costs of litigation, and we... Our total recovery will be about $1.6 million into the Consumer Protection, Education, and Revolving Account as a recovery based on the costs of the litigation itself. With that, if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Shepherd briefly review the projected payment schedule with respect to Oregon itself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the special counsel to Attorney General Myers. What you have before you is the most basic statement of payments from the companies to Oregon. And I say most basic because none of the adjustments that are potentially applicable to any of these payments are included except for the payments referred to in the year 2000. And there we have included the both our expectation as to the payment we're going to receive in January and an estimate as to the payment that will be received subsequently in April. But the remainder of these, there's been no adjustment whatsoever to any of the raw figures. These are the figures as set out in the settlement agreement. So with that caution, I think the chart is fairly self-explanatory in the sense that the first column shows what are identified in the Master Settlement Agreement as initial payments to the states. The second column shows what are identified in the Master Settlement Agreement as annual payments, and it's important to recall, as I know you know from the briefing you've already received, these payments are perpetual, and there has been some misperception of the idea that these would come to an end after 25 years, and that's not the case, as you know. And finally, there is the category of strategic payments, which will begin in the year 2008. Each of these categories of payments are subject to various kinds of adjustments under the terms of the Master Settlement Agreement. I'll just briefly mention three. Again, I know that you've heard some of these previously. One is an adjustment that will apply. It's identified in the Master Settlement Agreement as the previously settling states adjustment, and that's just a percentage reduction to represent the fact that several states had already settled and so were not included directly in the Master Settlement Agreement when it was entered into. Second adjustment that's of significance is the volume adjustment, and I'm sure you've heard discussion of that. And finally, the inflation adjustment, which again, I know that you've heard something about in terms of projections. These projections over time are very difficult because of the variables involved in the various adjustments. And so for me, it's been most helpful as I'm thinking through what the schedule of payments looks like to try and ground that discussion as much as I can in what the raw figures from the Master Settlement Agreement.
Mr. Chair, I understand the adjustments are complicated, but I can't quite square even the unadjusted figures on your schedule with those on page 6 of the... do you have this? Did you see this?
I haven't seen it. Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly.
I was handed one out in the hall. I haven't looked at it yet.
It seems like the unadjusted, we ought to have some agreement there. And these,
right.
page six, the total amounts do seem to be a few million dollars difference here and there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Strobeck, or Mr. Chair, let me take a look here.
Sorry to catch you off guard.
Representative Shetterly, which line are we looking at?
Well, if you look on page six, under their total column, that was represented to us as the Oregon's portion of the unadjusted settlement proceeds, and I would expect that that would agree with your right-hand column.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I don't know whether the figures you're looking at on page six have been adjusted.
No, they say unadjusted. He says no inflation, no volume.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I don't know whether they've been adjusted for the previously settling states adjustment, which is an arithmetic calculation, and I don't know whether whether the figures you're looking at on this chart have been adjusted for that. Mine have, the figures I presented to you have not been. I think that's approximately 14%, and maybe if you do apply the 14%, for example, to the $86 million on my chart, you come close to the total of $79 million that's represented on page six. In a quick glance, that's the best explanation I can give you for that.
Mr. Chair?
I think at the very least what this points out is that these are still very squishy numbers and that there's a lot of adjusting to be done. Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepard, I had a related question to Representative Shetterly. And you were listening to the testimony from the Morgan Stanley person who was here earlier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm afraid I didn't have the opportunity to do that.
I guess he came in while he was talking. And maybe it's then a question for the Attorney General. Did you generally agree with the assumptions and sort of that line of analysis that we were getting? Have you had
Strobeck,
to look at it?
Representative Rosenbaum, I only heard about 5 minutes of the presentation. I came in just about the time he was concluding, so I'm not sure I can really respond to your question at this moment.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Williams?
Attorney General Myers, Pete, maybe you can tell me, is the strategic payments segment or the, I guess, strategic contribution fund, is that subject to all the same adjustments as the rest of the master settlement agreement, or are those protected from some of those adjustments? Either one of you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, the strategic payments are subject to many of the same adjustments. One that they are not subject to is the previously settled states reduction adjustment.
Okay, they are subject to the volume adjustment, however.
Yes, that's correct, and the inflation adjustment, the non-participating manufacturer adjustment, the federal tobacco legislation adjustment, and the litigating releasing parties adjustments.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I think I neglected earlier when I mentioned the Oregon award from the Strategic Contribution Fund to have mentioned the amount, which was approximately $207 million. And it will be spread over, I believe it's in years, beginning in 2008. Mr. Chair, that concludes my initial presentation and that of Mr. Shepard. We'd be happy now to try to assist the committee with any further questions or information to the Attorney General.
Representative Pifori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is somewhat along the lines of Representative Rosenbaum's question. Although you didn't get to hear the presentation made earlier, he was recommending a course of action for the state of Oregon in how to handle our tobacco settlement payments, and I'm wondering if you have a recommendation for us, what you think we should do.
Chair Strobeck, Representative Kafori, I don't know at this point that I could respond on a very informed basis about the securitization issue. I think that's a cost-benefit ratio question, and I think probably a very good case could be made for securitization. As to the use of the funds, I guess my views about that are footed in the fact that this revenue stream the litigation underlying it, and the litigation underlying it are entirely about smoking, misconduct in relation to the marketing of tobacco products, the public health costs of smoking. It's all about that. The revenue stream itself is arising, I assume, dominantly, if not exclusively, from smoking. And so I think that, A, this revenue stream should not be seen as a windfall to be impounded as a strategic reserve for the state, to be quite honest about it. I think it should be used. And that's the foundation reason for my opposition to House Bill 2007. It's impoundment of the principle into a prudent person reserve. I just disagree with that, given the origins of this stream, in the terms that I've already mentioned. Secondly, I think that in terms of using it, the priority claims for it ought to be in relation to health-related programs, tobacco or smoking prevention and cessation programs, anti-tobacco marketing. I think since the revenue stream arose from the efforts of our consumer protection section and its counterparts in other states, I think a small portion of the total stream should be devoted to enhancing our own consumer protection efforts, which of course include efforts related to tobacco. And we submitted a specific proposal during the session. But a very small fraction of the total stream could make a dramatic difference. In any event, in sum, Chair Strobeck and Representative Kefouri, my views are that the stream is a special kind of trust for the state. It shouldn't be seen as a windfall, the source of a sort of a surplus buildup, that it should be used and that its priority uses should have some relationship to the underlying litigation, which gave rise to it.
Well, following up on that, I assume that as you and other attorneys general have met, you've talked about these purposes, and I'm just looking at the one of the reports on page 14 from the previous speaker. Texas is using part of the money for school construction. Oklahoma is using it for higher education. Virginia for transportation, and Alabama to incent Toyota to locate a facility in the state. And so, what has how have other states chosen to depart from your course of recommended action here, and in exclusively dedicating it to tobacco and enforcement?
Chair Strobeck, several states have, I guess, departed. I'm aware of that. And of course, I'm not naive. I understand that the allure of a new source like this is going to create a lot of demands on the fund from very compelling and competing uses. So I'm not here to assert to this committee that my prescription has been adopted at this point on any kind of widespread or universal basis, but only that it's my opinion as to what the right outcome is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Williams.
Attorney General Myers, and I know you didn't have the benefit, and so this is like the fourth question to ask you about something the previous speaker said that you never heard.
And I
apologize for that in advance. But you've got his little packet in front of you. Would you turn to page 8 in that packet? Because I want to understand your concept of how you think the fund should be used. So I'm interested in making sure I understand what you're saying. I'd like you to look at that statement that he's provided us in page 8 in that paragraph and tell me whether that's consistent or inconsistent with what you've just said.
Well, depending on, Chair Strobeck, Representative Williams, depending on what the term support operations means, I think it's consistent.
Can you, because what I thought I heard you say when you said we ought to use it was the sense that you didn't like the idea of a trust fund. You like the idea of it being available in kind of a general fund, spend it as we get it, sort of an approach, which seems to me to be inconsistent with what the previous representative from Morgan Stanley had suggested by this quote. But I wasn't sure, and so I wanted just some clarification from you as to whether or not you agreed with that or disagreed with it.
Chair Strobeck, Representative Williams, if the statement in terms of recommending against use of the funds to support operations means that the funds shouldn't be used for the kinds of programs I was describing earlier, then I disagree with the statement.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the lines of what the chairman had listed as activities that some states were using these proceeds for from the Master Tobacco Settlement Agreement. Colorado, the treasurer there has obviously sought and received some legal counsel, and in that process moved to securitize the fund so that the ultimate goal would be to eliminate the conflict of interest between the receipt of the funds and the state's tobacco cessation efforts. Do you see the utilization, I think I know the answer to this, but do you see the utilization for some specialized housing projects and senior issues and so forth, particularly those that are elderly and frail and feeble? Do you see that there might be a conflict of interest if we didn't move towards a securitization position?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Butler, if I understand the question, the conflict arises from the possible effects of using the money to fight smoking on the amount of the revenue that's coming in. That's the conflict I understand. Yeah. Well, I think that could be a factor. Even unconsciously at work in the legislative process, as members are asked to devote or to commit revenues to a purpose which could reduce the amount of revenue coming in. And securitization, as I gather he was arguing, or the Colorado treasurer at least has asserted, is a way of getting out of eliminating that factor. And I suppose that's another consideration to build into the assessment of cost versus benefits of securitization. Ultimately, it seems to me, whether or not it's in the context of a securitized fund or securitization, the use of the funds in a way that has a relationship to the creation of the stream in the first place, smoking, tobacco, public health issues, is an issue of political will in the assembly. Bottom line, it's ultimately a matter of political will. And the absence of securitization could, with this conflict, create another impediment to executing that will. But nonetheless, it's a question of political will, in my opinion.
Follow up, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it's your opinion that at present that under House Bill 207, that does not preclude us from still coming back and setting up an actual fund through this securitization process.
Well, Chair Strobeck, Representative Butler, I probably would at the moment have to yield to the Treasurer's Office for analysis on that, but I would think that it would require... It might require some further legislative action. Now, that might not be seen as politically inconsistent with 2007 if the proceeds of the securitization were used in the same way that 2007 compels.
Right.
And that's my beef. It's the impounding of the revenue, whether it's obtained through securitization or whether it's left to come in over the the schedule set forth in the agreement, it's the impoundment of so much of that revenue into essentially a prudent person reserve, as opposed to uses. It's a value judgment, I realize, and reasonable people can disagree, of course, but I'm just giving you my opinion.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Attorney General, it seems like what makes this less than an academic discussion is the fact that voters will still have to approve our referral, and there are a number of other proposals that are being floated or talked about being put on the ballot. I guess two questions for you. One is, will you be in a position to help us or help voters decipher those proposals as to whether they meet the criteria that you've laid out for us today that you think we should be using? And the second question, I guess this is pretty theoretical, but it occurs to me that if states start using these kinds of proceeds for purposes very unrelated to the basis of the lawsuit that generated them, in a way you could argue that that's going to cause a proliferation of class action lawsuits against major product manufacturers, because in the same sense that people argue that we get addicted to the lottery as a source of revenue, can't states also possibly get addicted to suing as a source of revenue?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Rosenbaum, first, I intend to state my opposition publicly to 2007 as the campaign goes on, and will make the best argument I can along the lines I've just made, that are going to be framed primarily in terms of the proposed impoundment of the principle. I certainly am going to be very reluctant to say that the specific uses for the interest that are in 2007 aren't worthy. And if we were starting from a point of trying to arrive at an overall set of uses that would account for most of the money, I don't think all of it in any biennium should be appropriated, probably as a prudent matter, but let's, I don't know what percentage, but the dominant proportion. Those particular uses that are in 2007 might well be included among recipients in some amount. The uses I was referring to earlier, I said I thought should be the priority uses. And if there were legislative judgment to include other uses of the kind that are in 2007, I mean, they're all very worthwhile. Fine. It's the impoundment of the principle, again, that's a troubling thing to me. Second point, yes, I suppose that the ability to see these kinds of recoveries as a sort of like general taxation revenue coming in and augmenting the general fund for any purpose, I suppose could make the effort to try to get them more attractive.
To follow up very quickly, Mr. Chair, my first question was really trying to get at the fact that these other initiatives that are proposed involve trumping strategies, and I worry quite a bit that in a campaign mode with people getting their information in 30-second sound bites, that it's very hard to evaluate how various initiatives people will be voting on interrelate. So my question was really, are you going to be in a position to give some kind of legal assessment of how those various proposals interrelate, and if one got more votes than the other, what would happen?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm sorry I misunderstood your question. The answer would be yes if we're asked by a source of a request we are entitled under law to respond to. We would give legal analysis as to the questions you've just noted.
Mr. Attorney General, when people sue for various reasons and get some sort of a big settlement, the money that they get out of a settlement is not generally come with strings that say you have to spend that only on the original purpose for which you brought the suit. So my question is, in the suits that Oregon participated in and Oregon brought, and in the master settlement agreement, is there anything that says that the states will only use these funds for public health, for smoking prevention, et cetera?
Chair Strobeck, no.
Okay. And my final question is, are you comfortable with the financial stability of the tobacco companies in your analysis, given the 15 or 30-year horizon, that in the event that the fund is not secured, that there will be steadiness of the revenue stream?
Chair Strobeck, I think there is definitely uncertainty about that, particularly with the further entry of the federal government into the litigation arena. I think that for, and I have no idea what the horizon with respect to the resolution of that case is going to be. We're not talking about tomorrow, that's for sure. So I think going out up to maybe a 6 to 10 year period, I think that the big issue will be the effect of the volume adjustment. We are going to see decline in smoking as a consequence of the agreement and of subsequent price increases that I presume will be coming. And the magnitude of those, I for one can't predict at this point, but I think that in all likelihood, the payments that are shown on this schedule are going to be less than are shown, the unadjusted figure. But perhaps not dramatically. And my suspicion would be that with a little careful planning, the appropriation from biennium to biennium, if we were to get to a point where we were purporting to use substantially all of the settlement proceeds as opposed to impounding them, I would think that we could arrive at we could either do one of two things. We could either await a full biennium's payments and then decide on the final appropriations. That's probably the way it should be done. If you were to appropriate on a basis that would anticipate one of the year's payments in that biennium, I would think that some kind of reservation or holdback, so to speak, would be prudent to anticipate a possible downturn of the amount itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Williams.
Attorney General Myers, when the material was put forward as the settlement and the preparation was going forward for the trial, was part of the evidence that the state was developing evidence reflecting the amounts of money that we had spent over a period of time out of the general fund towards health care related to tobacco-associated illness?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Williams, yes.
And
Medicaid.
The Medicaid. So essentially some of the argument was we had a certain amount of money in our general fund. We spent that money on health care-related Medicaid costs as a result of tobacco-oriented illness. And now we're telling you, tobacco company, we want that money back. Is that right?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Williams, yes.
And during the period of time, part of this time, I would assume that we went back even to the period of time when you were Speaker of the House. Am I right about that in the calculation of the monies we were owed?
A long time.
I just wonder. I mean, I may be wrong about that.
How long will this cross-examination
take? Oh, it's not a cross-examination.
Chair Strobeck, Representative Williams, I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't remember, and nor does Mr. Shepard, the total period of the damage model or calculations that were being used.
But you'd agree that at least during a period of time, would you, that there was monies being spent towards tobacco-related illnesses from the Medicaid fund, which was essentially unavailable for other expenditures within the general fund, other programs that might have had additional participation in those revenues if we weren't in a position to have to spend them on tobacco-related illness?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Williams, I presume that's probably so.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Thank Chair, you, with Mr. The cross-examination just fresh in my mind, I want to correct a previous answer I gave to Representative Fairley. I estimated the previously settled state's reduction at 14%. The exact amount would be between now and 2007, the reduction is 12.45% and a slightly differing amounts in subsequent years of the settlement. But I didn't want to have to defend that 14% at a later date.
Thank you very much for coming over. We appreciate you making the time for us this morning. We're going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and wrap up with Steve Meyer and the tax incident study, and before we take our lunch break. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.